time to cast off on a new adventure. This is Real Adventures with Patrick Dangerfield and Aaron Hadgood.
Good morning and welcome to Real Adventures from wherever you are listening right around the country. Patrick Dangerfield and Aaron Hadgood joining you this morning to talk all things fishing, boating, the great outdoors, the outdoor industry at large. Now, Redmond, you've had a bit of a mixed week this week, old boy.
G'day, everyone. Mixed week. Not a bad... I'm waiting for Curry to pop.
Yes.
So I'm sticking...
40 weeks pregnant yesterday.
So I'm sticking very close to home, like not going too far away. I mean, spent the night in Apollo Bay during the weekend.
Yeah.
90 Ks offshore. Was that close to home?
Yeah, well, that's why I was going to kick it off with a mixed bag for the week, because
you knew. Didn't get in trouble.
At the start of the week, she was at 39 a bit, and you've decided, yeah, I'll go down to Apollo Bay, a three-hour drive down south, and I'll fish 90 kilometres offshore in chase of some reported
barrel bluefin
monster
tuna.
Southern bluefin tuna.
Yeah, young fella Zeph, who fished with me during the week, at Apollo Bay, I should say, he got some nice fish with a couple of his mates. The boys did really well. 90 kilo fish, there's been a few big ones. I've reports of a 167. That's a big tuna.
That's a big fish.
Yep. Now
there's two reefs. Well, two popular reef systems off Apollo Bay.
Yep, and then there was the oil rig.
And well-known, big reef and little reef.
Yep, and it's...
They didn't put a huge amount of time into the naming of these reefs, but they're a very popular tuna haunt. And then if you go further, which is just before you knock on the door of Tasmania and just before you hit Antarctica...
And via New Zealand.
You decide to hit the oil rig. It's something that you've got to plan for. You've got to pick your weather because you are fishing a long way offshore.
Pat, it's stupid. It's actually stupid. Like, I don't know. Just to put it into perspective, it is so far out. I did it last year, and in the end, we ended up off Big Reef. And just to give you an example, Big Reef's close, and it's still 55 kilometres from the ramp.
There you go.
Not just that. As you come out of Apollo Bay, you get to the Otway. And the Otway, I think it's roughly, I might be, correct me if I'm wrong, someone will, roughly 25 kilometres from the Cape Otway, depending where you look and the angle you look at. 25 kilometres. So you get in, coming back, you're like, oh yeah, I'm nearly in, I'm at the Cape, I'm at the Otway, and you've still got 25 k's to the boat ramp, and that's actually the most roughest water of the whole trip.
You've got those two tide and water bodies that are significantly challenging.
Yep.
So they're not quite there that, yet though.
They're there. There's fish there, but I cracked it, to tell you the honest truth. I got out to the rigs and there was a lot of people. I don't know. I went the buffer zone around the gas and oil rig pad for 500 metres. And
so you cannot go any closer than 500 metres.
All those barrels I got last year and 60, 70 kilo fish were all, say, maybe 3 to 15 kilometres from it, most of them. Where all the smaller fish are hanging underneath the rig.
I was going to say they're right there.
Yeah.
Fish are attracted to structure.
Well, the big fish are.
That's the only structure that's hitting the surface.
The big fish are, if they're not working up, they're under those, they're under the rig. People are marking them up under the rig.
Yeah.
But you're not allowed close 500 metres. I snuck in at one stage. I reckon I got to 400. I'm like, quickly get out of here. Like, I didn't want to do the wrong thing. Like, get out of here too close. Like, get out. Mate, there was people there not even 5 metres from the rig. Like, there's probably 8 boats, 10 boats out there. Then they're dropping pillies under the rig. Like, that's up to them. That's their own issue. Over the radio, the tug, the oil rig guys on the radio, they get out of here. You're taking your photos being sent to authority. But the worst part about it was those rig tenders, the rig tugs, I like to call them, they're big red boats. They're massive. They're like 60 metres. The rig makes them look small.
Yes.
These things are ginormous. Well, if they... I actually think their horn's bigger than their engine, because the horn, when they blow it, it vibrates that loud through your ears. It feels like, I haven't got much brain in there, but it shakes them all. And they are blowing horns nonstop there to get, like, just basically to pee us off. Like, that's what I think they're doing. And it is so loud. We got out of there. I went to Big Reef and stayed there. I held up Big Reef for maybe 2 hours. Nothing happened. I went in. I was back in by 1 o'clock. I regretted everything about it. The biggest regret was not taking your boat, because my little 6 meter, it's so far out there. You got no idea. One thing I was impressed with, we did 212 kilometers and we used 157 liters of fuel.
It's efficient, especially
very efficient.
especially when you don't exactly take a huge amount of care around your Rev Ranger throttle.
No, Patrick, I have to now because I won't lie to you. I had to get home and I had to re-put the pacemaker back into position. I seriously thought it was going to fall out. I had to pull the spine out of my backside when I got in, just how far out we're traveling.
Pull it back up to your throat.
Oh, you've got no idea how far you're out. I don't care what you're in. If you're in a ship, it's that far out. But like you said before, little reef, big reef, the rigs, very good spots to chase these tuna, and it's going to happen in the next coming days, weeks, whatnot.
Do you reckon, like, on the back of Structure providing incredible fishing?
Yep.
And we see Vic Fisheries every year. They put out the fish aggregating devices, the FADs. Like, what if there was a used, finished up oil rig that they could position and just leave? Like, how good would the fishing be if you manoeuvred it so it was, you know, slightly closer into land, say not 80 kilometres offshore? And obviously this is hypothetical and it's something that wouldn't happen, but how good would the fishing be if it
was in the right spot
dotted along the coast in, well, as you said, in the right spots,
it'd be incredible because, so what happens here, you get a nice current pushing up from that Tasmania, from the edge of Tasmania up, and then also the Portland water, Warrnambool water, that nice ocean current from the Southern Ocean pushes through those areas, and that oil rig happens to be in that area.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, you should see, I've seen some of the footage of the boys that were fishing under the oil rig. And
crazy.
Mate, just the amount of life underneath that thing. And
well, you see it when you see those oil rigs off the States and you see the swordfish underneath
them. Yep.
And you think, well, that looks like, I can't really gauge the size of this swordfish. It's 3 meters long because the oil rigs are so ginormous. Yeah, you sort of lose your depth perception on how big these fish
sort
are.
Sort of. Last year, I got to the first time I went to the oil rig last year. This is, I'm hanging a lot of crap on myself here. We come out, we've never been out there before. And the oil rig's in the distance. And I said, oh, the boys.
Are you nervous 80 k's offshore in a 6 meter boat?
No, it hasn't. I haven't been. No, not once yet. But I did stuff up here bad. I looked at the oil rig and I said, the boys, how far do you reckon we are? We're not out within 500. I said, should we put the lures in here or what? And Kane goes, nah, we'll still be a few Ks off. I said, yeah, I don't know. I said, how do I measure it? I'm trying to measure it. I'm saying we're like 15. Nah, it must have moved off. Like, it must have moved or something. I was 15 kilometres from it. I was 15 kilometres.
You're taking health and safety protocol very seriously.
I couldn't believe how much of an idiot I was. And the boys weren't, like, they were, like, trying to, like, I think they knew that, I don't know, thing's massive. That's all I can say. When you're up near it, like, the people that are on the edge of it look like ants walking on it. It's that big and it's that high up. Like, they literally look like ants. Like, they're that small. It's a massive, massive oil rig. Anyway.
Well, they have to be to survive the incredible weather that you're going to get.
Anyone that works on one's an idiot as well, because I would never work out there in summer of the sea. I've got a fellow that lives in Ocean Grove that, through a friend, I've spoke to him, and he reckons it's, he goes out there, 5-6 meter swells. He reckons the thing literally just rot, like it's on a floating, the way it floats, but the design of it. He goes, it's moving that much. He goes, like, you can't even stand up. He goes, he reckons it's that. Well, you're on floating. Like, he goes, it's just, and the waves breaking over. You got to think, Southern Ocean, medium Bass Strait. This water is horrid.
And it's not deep.
No, it's only 80 to 100 meters.
Like, so you think, oh, you know.
You're not in 2,000-3,000 where you get a nice roll.
Exactly.
You know, it's hitting that shelf and then pushing up onto the.
That's
plus
why
you've got the
Bass
current.
Bass Strait is such a
treacherous bit of water.
Absolutely.
Anyway, it's if you want to go to Apollo Bay, take a aeroplane pilot seat because you need something to sit on.
How far away do you think consistent captures of southern bluefin tuna barrels are? Because
it's any day.
Because we've seen, we've had an incredible season of the school tuna. Like, we're seeing consistent captures through quite a large number of commercial operators up and down the Victorian coastline, seeing it right through Victor Harbour, South Australia.
Mallacoota Way.
Like, it's been phenomenal.
It's the school fish that were there last year, the 15, 10s, the jelly beans, whatnot. They are in plague proportions out on these oil rigs. Proportions. They're everywhere. The whole way, even through Big Reef and Little Reef, they were everywhere. Yeah, they were everywhere. Well, I had no interest in them.
Yep.
I didn't drive
you're not,
an hour and a half in the car to Apollo Bay, stayed the night there, and then 90 k's like in the boat out there to catch a 20 kilo school tuna when they're out the front of my house.
You're not curious as to whether there's some big girls sitting underneath those school fish?
100%. I dropped some pillies trying to get through them. The schoolies were bad,
yep.
But they were.
Is there anything you can do to avoid the school southern bluefin and get to those big ones?
Just keep working through them. Just gotta keep. I know some of the guys. Look, Zeph, for example, the fish that he had a double hookup. There's roughly 90 kilo fish, say. And they were, he had school fish eating 10, 12 inch lures, like constantly eating those lures. Like that day, you got the two. And then when the rods went off, the boys literally fought, argued who was going to wind the school fish in, because they're like, oh, not again. Because they're hard on 50 wise. Like it's an effort to wind them
in. It's not fun.
Nah. And then Zeph
you've got a winch.
Poor Zeph jumped on the rod and ended up being attached to a 90 kilo tuna, which ended up all right for him.
Yeah.
But it's, like I said before, getting off the oil rigs when those workups come, those seals, those dolphins, the whales, when they're going to be tight on those patches of bait balls, those barrels are going to be working on, and the gannets, you can go down there now and you will catch fish. You've got a very good chance of getting a big fish, but I don't like very good chance for 90 kilometres.
It's a long day.
Yeah, and I'd rather go out in a rougher day and be told that I'm going to catch fish than a nice calm day like I had and potential of catch. It's a long, you don't understand, like what I'm trying to say to you, how long way. I spoke to three mates who were out there that day, and they said they're never doing it again. Like, it's that far. Like, it's not just around the corner, Pat. It's not drive.
Fisherman's favourite.
Famous last words.
Like,
Kane and I said this last
week. As the next week hits and goes, oh, I'm just going to give it one more go.
Every time we went back last year, we said we're not doing that again. We went back the next 3 days later. So, it's a fantastic fishery. It's unbelievably good. But, like I said, my spine's just starting to repair itself now. You need a big boat as well. I think your boat would be the ideal. You sit in a bit of comfort, but even your boat, like a 750, would still, like, it's, my boat's a great little boat, but it's
big. It's big your hours
boat,
in the water.
It's big. It's just it's 2 hours of anyway, it's a long time to Apollo Bay, but it's a great fishery.
Hey, Ram, they're looking at their 1200.
I'm looking at their car too, by the way, Patrick.
It's a good topic of conversation.
Yep.
They're 1200 finally getting ready to rumble, potentially in Australia, but launching in the South American markets as early as next year, 2023. Now, this is the same size spec as what a Toyota Hilux and Ford Ranger are. Do you see any uptake in the Australian market, given the reason that Australian consumers purchase Rams is that they're getting something that Ford, Toyota don't currently offer in the marketplace, being a vehicle that'll tow 3.5 tons plus.
That's how I vision it, straight up.
Yeah.
Straight up, I vision, hence why I'm saying looking at a Ram, because I'm looking at a bigger boat.
Yep.
Also your boat too, to tow your boat, as well as, because I want to get a 650 or a 750.
You can legally tow them.
You can legally tow the just standard though, pretty.
But the comfortability of it is not there in a boat that's that big. You do need the extra juice of a bigger car.
You do. And the reason I look at Ram is, just like you said before, is purely for the towing aspect.
Yep.
And you and I aren't car people. We both aren't. We love our cars, don't get me wrong, because we need to get...
There's
purpose behind our cars. We've got cars for the purpose. That's why we use our cars. We're not going to go buy a Lamborghini, are we? Because we're not into a Lamborghini. It's just something we're not... No purpose for us. We're a boat, has a purpose, and a trailer, like a Ram. Your car, my car, both can't tow your boat fully loaded. We just can't do it. It's not legal fully loaded, like properly loaded for a big marlin trip. It's not safe.
400 litres of fuel,
it's just
all
not,
that.
It's just not safe. And even if it is, it's still, your boat's so big, Pat. Like, it's such a big boat. And that's where the Ram aspect, or your Land Cruiser, or whatever it is, like,
but even a Land Cruiser.
With an upgraded Land Cruiser.
That's the thing, you're spending 150.
That's what I was just about to say.
And then you're spending an extra 10.
Well, Jake's car, the John Marine, was $200,000 Land Cruiser. Like, it's just ridiculous the money that goes into it, plus an expensive boat. So I look at Ram as a car you can go out and buy.
That's not something that you're buying in that small range.
Exactly. You're not something. That's how I look at it. Are you the same as that?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
yeah, I understand the reasoning behind it as the purpose of towing, but this is different. Hey, school holidays aren't too far away. They're a couple of weeks away now, or a week away now. When it comes to getting your family onto and into fishing, jetty, beach fishing, those sorts of things, as we hit the school holidays, some simple tips for you around what to look for, how to navigate around the crowds, because a lot of the time it's the stress of, geez, there's a lot of people around. Yep. I don't want to look stupid in front of other people or look silly because I don't know what I'm doing. Beach fishing, let's start with that.
Beach fishing, I'd be going somewhere not cold for kids.
Yeah, so you want protection.
You want protection, so you want to get offshore winds. That's the ideal situation. So if say your place, Pat, Moggs Creek, you're not going down there with George on a 15 to 20 knot southerly. You'll be going down there on a nice northerly wind, northwesterly wind, and it's going to be offshore. It's going to be calm. And what I mean by offshore, the wind's coming off the land to the ocean. So wherever you are in the country, literally
you
land.
Can find yourself some protection.
Find yourself some protection for the kids. If you're going to go to a pier, something similar to, you want to have the wind behind your back. You don't want it in your face because that's when it gets cold. And as
it's
well,
it's also easier to fish because your lines aren't being pushed back to your to either the shore or fishing from the ocean or on a jetty. Like you
that's
want
how I'm
easy.
Doing it for myself. Yeah, you're spot on. And just one thing that I've learned with having a little fella, and I know I used to ask you for a bit of advice, was one thing that I've learned having Finn when I take him fishing is a bucket of water, a simple bucket of water, and fish in the bucket of water just to keep them busy. Like it just kills the entertainment. Like if you get... Make sure to do the right things with your guidelines. I'm not getting into that rubbish,
but find a crab and put it in there.
Find a crab, something simple. Whatever.
Release it at the end.
Exactly, something simple. Something simple for the kids to keep entertained, depending on their ages. Like getting as they get a bit older and whatnot. I was referring to my child who's two, but entertainment is the key for young right through to, I reckon, that. What would you say? They probably start to get patience around that 12, from my experience. 12,
I think so, yeah.
12 is when the patience sort of start to kick in. They start to understand that if they wait that for that snapper, they could get that bigger fish, where before that, you're doing your squid, you're doing your whiting, and you're having a bit of fun. Keep it entertained. Bucket of water, simple. Put a little Tommy Ruff in there if you have to, and you're going to keep them down there for the extra hour, so you can have that next beer and catch, hopefully, that big mulloway off the beach.
Patrick Dangerfield and Aaron Habgood joining you this morning for Real Adventures. We've got a huge show all on the other side of the break and beyond. This is Real Adventures.
You're listening to Real Adventures with Patrick Dangerfield and Aaron Habgood.
Welcome back to Real Adventures. It's time to find out what's biting in your part of the country. We kick off with New South Wales, Redmond. We're still seeing some good captures of some fish with some pointy noses, particularly around that that Bermagui region.
Yeah, Headhunter Charter's got some beautiful fish during the week. I know he went 3-3-3, so which is when they refer to as 3-3-3. I mean, three fish raised, three fish hooked, three fish landed.
Yep.
So if you see a 21-21-21, they've had a real good day. So it's still good to see. Botany Bay inland, Benito are back, Pat. The unweighted pilchards on small hooks, they're the key, and they're doing the best work. So what he means by unweighted, light leaders and letting the pilchards fall through the water column as much as possible, rather than having, say, for instance, a pea sinker or whatnot,
yes,
which doesn't make it sink as natural. So pea sinkers are good. Harbour Kings, live squid up to 80 centimetres. So some really good harbour.
That's some good size.
Yeah, really good Harbour Kings, which is good to see. We haven't had much reports of them inside in the last couple of weeks, but it's really that water's starting to clean up a little bit, so we should start to see them. South Australia,
Redmond. Well, I'll let you kick it off because I was focusing a bit on Queensland, but you go.
Righto. Birkenhead, Southbridge, Australia. Brim on prawn soft plastics. Really, really good at the moment. And as bycatch, lots of slimy mackerel. One thing with slimy mackerel, I'll give you a little hint, doesn't freeze well. Does not freeze well for bait or for food. So,
as opposed to Australian salmon.
Yeah, salmon isn't ideal, but it's so much better, and I freeze it all the time for bait. Salmon still goes a little bit soft, but it's it definitely, the way you can demonstrate the bait on a hook or present the hook bait on a hook is actually run it in a chunk form so the flesh isn't open. So run
otherwise
it
gets too mushy and it just falls off.
Yeah, too mushy. Another good way for the slimy mackerel, you can always salt it too. The tuna run is still going really good. Ned McHenry from the Adelaide Crows, good friends of the Real Adventures show. And he's been, does he even play footy?
He spends more time with the boat.
Oh, he's doing very well on the tuna. And do you know, where's he out of? I know I've asked you this before. Is he Victor Harbour area?
Victor.
He's out of Victor because I got a report here. Victor Harbour, the key tuna. But don't forget, one thing that the tuna has destroyed in the offshore world is the bottom fishing. And what I mean by that is I don't ever fish for gummies anymore or snapper offshore because these bloody tuna take my attention. So if you do want some bottom fish, make sure you do it. They eat better, in my opinion, than tuna, I believe. I know.
But they're not as fun. That's the thing.
Oh, this is the killer. I don't know. Gummies are going well out of Victor Harbour. You got Morwong, you got school sharks, you got nannies, and they're just fishing well. So don't get too distracted all the time, maybe a lot of the time. Go, Patrick, to Queensland.
Queensland. Now, Bribie Island, it's now being declared that there is a Bribie Island bar, Redmond.
We spoke about this last week.
Well, we've spoken about the dangerous waters that we've continually seen, but the beach spit is now officially declared as a Bribie Island, or the Bribie Island bar. So the entire island has been renamed to have a North and a South Island. So that will now reflect on all of Queensland's marine charts for the southeastern waters.
And safety regulations with life jackets, crossing bars, etc.
All of that, exactly right. So a big change for that region, something that bar is not going to return. So it's not like it's going to be infilled, so that's there to stay, which means...
Well, I thought you were talking about a new bar opening in Queensland. I was excited.
No. Bribie Island, the coastal bar. Right. So that now means wearing a life jacket while navigating the bar, if you've got a boat that's less than 4.8 metres, it is compulsory under the state's maritime laws that you have to wear a life jacket.
Well, the Tweed, the drain off Tweed River, speaking of another bar, the Tweed River can be a bit of a prick at times, as we know, to get out of there. The drain, which is known as the drain, is fishing really well. Taylor, Flathead, going really well as salmon too. Now, that's a mixed bag of fish in the shallows off the surf. So that's off the drain. So that's literally land-based. So if you're a land-based fisher, make sure you get amongst it. Heading to Tasmania, the Craigieburn is fishing really, really good. Rainbows and browns, but the big rainbows, like the eight sort of pound stuff. So that's going well, and they're on hard bodies and small soft plastics.
There's still really good reports of the offshore fishing as well. Like, it depends how much time and effort you're willing to put into it. I know our great mate Paul Westling of iFish, he's heading down there over the school holidays and chasing some swords.
Well, there was big sword. Indy Thomas got some big swordfish out of St. Helens, which is great to see. And I like this. This is a good one I read. And I'd always love a report on social media. This is in the Sportsfish Tasmania page. Thanks to the bloke who said the fish were on the bite at Badgers at the boat ramp. 50 metres heading towards Deport stick bait. So if you're a local, you know exactly what that means. Bloody great day out. Dinner was awesome. Fish went nuts. Thanks a lot. And he's got photos here of bag limit of 30-plus kilo tuna. So that's great to see that fellow fishermen helping each other out of the ramps to get amongst these pelagic fish, which can move very quickly. But if you're in the right direction and look for the right things, you will catch fish. And that was the whip around this week, Patrick.
Nice work, Redmond. It's time for the social club. We take your questions from social media each and every week. So if you want to get in contact with Aaron or I, make sure you send in a direct message to our social pages, whether it be Facebook or Instagram, and we'll do our very best to get back to you. First question is from Michael. G'day, boys. Love the show and would love to know how you guys set up your tackle boxes. I don't know where to start. I love my fishing. I'm really no good at it. Give me some advice, Michael.
I'm not even going to answer this because, do you know those green Safeway bags? They're my tackle boxes. So I might actually pass this one on to you because you're much more organized when it comes to your tackle boxes. I run out of bags.
Yours, you're a bit different because you do it as a
every day.
I've gone over my fishing journey from having everything under the sun set up in my boat to now, and I've got this with the 750 and I've got a little Stabycraft. Now, I've basically got three tackle boxes that have everything in it, but they're not very big, and they're always stored in the boat.
What do you mean by everything in it, though? Like, what do you mean? Like, the stuff that we catch in the area?
I mean, a full hook sizes from whiting to sharks.
Yep.
But I don't have a stack of it.
So you just got enough?
I've got enough, so I can, you know, pick up the boat and away I go. Now, if we're targeting something specific, like fishing for kingfish, then I'll load up the bungee cast. I've got one of those in each of those.
So you'll have it in the boat already, but you have, or if you're specifically targeting a certain species, you'll take extra.
Yeah. So that way, sort of, I feel like I, there's nothing I can forget.
Yeah.
Because I've got the bare minimum in each boat. Because I can fishermen, we're all guilty. We bring so much gear, yeah, and then we lose track of where it's all bloody at.
I struggle here. I can't get organized with my tackle. I just can't. I've tried so many times. I literally spend set times. I have the boys come over, and I even say to the boys, well, what do you think? Like, you guys, do it how you think. Like, and then you pack a tackle box, and you might go, all right, gummy sharks. But then you put swivels in there for gummy sharks. But then you go to something else, and then you're like, well, that's in that box. Well, why are we putting it in this box as well?
But that's why I have, so I've got like, you know, my, so you just, my 30 grammers for Australian salmon in the same tackle box that I've got hooks, that I've got swivels, mm-hmm, that I've got split rings, just one of each. It's a real generic box that covers everything.
Yeah.
Because I've got them literally under my skipper's seat. There's sort of trays.
So you've got them built in under your seats?
On both boats.
Both boats, yeah.
Yep. And then for what is, you know, we're going fishing for tuna, you'll go, all right, you need this, or yeah, I'll bring what I've got for that. And then it's more specified.
I just can't get a system. And this is all the time. I just can't. It just feels like I'm, so I'll take out like bungee casting one tub, and then I'll have another tub go, all right, well, there's your small surface. But then all of a sudden someone will go, I'll get them on poppers. Then I've got another tub for poppers. And then all of a sudden I've got 55 tubs full of random stuff. That doesn't actually, it doesn't actually have a, it's not practical to what you're trying to do. So what I've actually done is I've just got a bag, a duffel bag. It's quite large and barely lifted up these days. And every time I just chuck handfuls of stuff in. So, but it's all in boxes.
Michael, we've done absolutely.
I can't answer the question. I'm sorry.
Nothing to answer the question, but that's sort of how we set up our tackle. Aaron, drifting for flathead. I'm really struggling to get anything of decent size. Cheers, Pete. Now, this goes along the lines of what people have forgotten to fish for with the craze for tuna at the moment. But there's still really good flathead being caught. I know you. I think you put some time in a couple of weeks ago.
And no, this week just gone. 68 centimeter one.
Did you really?
An absolute monster. I don't even think I sent you the photo.
So what are people forgetting when they set themselves up in order to catch?
Just showing Patrick the photo there, a little, nice little wink from
him. Stop bragging to me. We've got a show to do.
Sorry, mate.
What are people missing when they're setting themselves up to drift for
fun? Oh, that was just bycatch.
you were fishing for tuna.
I was fishing for tuna. It took a lure. No, I was actually fishing for whiting when they come along.
It took a 12-inch skirt.
I did catch a harpooka, which is a deep sea fish, 400 meter fish, on a skirt out of Portland when I was a kid. Believe it or not. Anyway, back to on topic. I flathead drifting for them. Anchoring is a good method.
Yeah, okay.
Don't just be set on drifting. In the bay, there's a lot of juvenile flathead, a lot of undersized stuff.
I think people get sometimes, especially when they fish offshore, they're like, "Oh, I'm in 30 meters of water. I don't want to set up an anchor now."
Well, I'd probably when you put it like that, I would be drifting for it. I would definitely be drifting for flathead because in the ocean, there's a lot bigger flathead you'll hit different patches of size fish. Gotcha. Where in the bay they tend to be smaller in the deeper water where people tend to drift.
So where you'd be more inclined to anchor, you said, in the bay?
Yeah, so anchor, what I like to do is I like to find heavy weed where you'd probably find the whiting with the sand holes mixed in with it. Yep. I like to actually,
where they'll sit and nestle themselves into the sand.
Yeah, yep. So I actually sit on the sand side up the bank a bit. So say, for instance, you're 5 meters of water, is where the whiting ground is with the weed and the sand holes. I actually like to move away from that, maybe 30 to 100 meters, get up on the sand.
You're nice.
Burly the sand, and those big ones will all come out of
those predatory fish just waiting.
Yep. They come out, and they'll literally sit in your boat. But the burly's the key for them in the bay. Burly, I don't drift for flathead in the bay. Anchor and burly the sand flats all the time for my flathead. In the ocean, I like to drift. So 30 meters of water. You need to find the right ground. The problem with flathead, they live on sand. Not many flathead live on rubble.
Yeah.
Gurnard live on rubble. Pinkies live on rubble. So if you're on the wrong ground, you'll get plagued by it. You'll get the odd flatty, but majority it lives on sand. So,
and you might see gurnard on a, you know, pub menu that you go to. Our advice is don't touch the spiny parts and put those into your body.
No, I cried for 8 hours one day. It's a horrible spike to get done by, but Paul Worsing's favourite fish, I think he calls it, gurnard. Yeah, to eat. They're a beautiful eating fish, gurnard. So if you do get a gurnard, handle it with care. Just a little bit of a tip here. Grab it by the head if possible. Let it die. Like if you can kill it, that's the ideal situation. And then cut the spines off with scissors.
Yep.
So bang, cut the top spines off. The bottom ones, the anal spines, they don't they hurt just naturally, but they don't have the actual bacteria, the poison, toxin, we like, yeah, to toxin in top of them, in the top of the spike, which will hurt you. So little tip, get rid of the spines, and they're a beautiful eating fish.
That was a social club. Make sure you send us in your messages or questions that you have for Aaron or I. We do our best every week to get back to everyone, which can be a struggle at times because we love the engagement from all our audience. Plenty more Real Adventures after the break.
Gearing up for Dometic. Dometic Patrol, an icebox with a sense of adventure. Everything you need for adventures, big or small. Mobile living made easy. Dometic.
It's time for gearing up for Dometic. Enjoy the great outdoors with all the comforts of home with Dometic. Our special guest this morning is Scott Jones, National Head of Sales, Marketing, R&D, Jayco. Morning, Scott.
How are you, Patrick? You're well?
Going very well, thank you. Thanks for joining us this morning. Now, 2.5 years ago, the caravan industry was certainly going through a transition period. It had been a really tough journey. Certainly speaking to a few in the industry, it wasn't as healthy as it's been. And then all of a sudden, a global pandemic hits. And what's preceded it has been an extraordinary rise again of touring Australia, and the caravan industry has been central to that.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, you know, coming into the pandemic, you know, we'd made a pretty strategic plan on what we wanted to do and the product range and category we wanted to focus on, and then the pandemic hit. That changed everything pretty much overnight, and there were a lot of things we had to consider. Coming into the pandemic, there were staffing issues, there were dealer issues that we had to tend with as well. But then before we knew it, within a few months, things leveled out, and then it absolutely took off. And, the reasons it took off were because, people wanted a safe and affordable way to travel, which RVing is the perfect way to do that. And with overseas travel off the cards and also cruises, they just saw us as the answer to everything that they needed to do. And we were very, very lucky. So, with that, there were other challenges as well with supply.
Quite extraordinary to think off the beginning of a pandemic, managing staff, and then managing staff for a different reason, needing to get more in.
Exactly. One thing at the moment, sorry, is staff. We've got a huge number of outstanding jobs. We're looking for people at the moment.
Now, you're in a unique position as a manufacturer, because when people think of caravanning in Australia, they do think Jayco. You've been market leaders for nearly 50 years. So that puts you, within a responsibility to provide the very best possible. Now, the full drive and auto industry, as we're seeing every week, seems to be changing enormously with the rise of EVs. What are we going to see the changes being with caravanning and Jayco? What are you going to provide for us over the coming year and the coming years around the technology improvements that you can provide consumers with?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. There's probably two aspects to that. We scour the globe for the latest in technologies. We go to the biggest trade show in the world, Dusseldorf in Germany, every year. There's also Open House in the US that US companies show their latest and greatest products on offer. And, one is the motorhome side of it, electric motorhomes. We're starting to see more of that overseas. Now, in Australia, we probably haven't got the infrastructure in place as yet or the distance in the vehicles. But one key focus for Jayco is off-grid capabilities for the adventure market. So people want to get away. And again, it's that... they want a safe way to travel, and if you're out in the middle of nowhere, you can still run your fridge. So lithium batteries, self-sufficiency, so you run your fridge days on end, increased solar capabilities, inverters, so you can still run your coffee machine, so you've still got all the, all the bells and whistles that you'd expect to have from home. So that's one of our core focuses.
So how's that going to, with all that new tech, one of the challenges around the electric capabilities of vehicles is the weight distribution. Now, it's offset because of obviously the fuel that you carry as a vehicle. Now, it's different when it comes to caravans, because this technology now provides the option to do what you've just said, Does it mean redesigning how you distribute the weight with the caravans? Because quite clearly with more batteries, that weight will go up.
Yeah, one of the beauties of the lithium battery, you know, with EV technology, it means there's further technology coming with lithium batteries, so more amp hours and everything. So that's transferring into, you know, our touring product. So you'll get a, you know, potentially a 200 amp hour battery that's, you know, probably a quarter of the weight of a 100 amp hour AGM battery. So that's one of the beauties of lithium. So we're very lucky in that respect. But, you know, what it does mean is that what you save in weight there, you're going to add in weight in other things. So, you know, potentially, you know, you might have bigger or more solar panels. So you're going to use up a bit of weight there. But, you know, fortunately, lithium battery weight's coming down, but, you know, solar capabilities gives us the opportunity to add more weight there. And, you know, the benefit of that means more time off-grid, you know, just a constant power supply to run your van.
When it comes to the construction of these all-terrain capabilities that you've spoken about, does that change the time it takes to manufacture these caravans? I'm assuming there's a huge amount that would go into the construction of it. What's the construction changes for you as a business, and how have you tailored to manufacture something that can withstand, you know, the Australian environment?
Yeah, one of the biggest things for us is a suspension system, and we developed our own some time ago, and we've continually improved on that. So we've actually got a unit going around a test track as we speak over the next 5 days with another iteration of suspension. So what we look at doing is, one, if you start with a suspension system, then everything else follows on from that. From the chassis, then your flooring, sidewalls. We think we've got one of the strongest sidewalls in the industry. So really strong, solid construction. And if you get the box right, I guess, if you call it that, then everything inside, will follow suit. So, we use stronger brackets and screws. We have looked at, other options down the track as well. We've recently moved to improve furniture construction, which means it's stronger, as well as more accurate with improved quality. So there are a lot of things that we do.
Considering, you know, what was put into a van 20 years ago compared to now, there's air conditioning throughout, there's toilets, showers, the kitchen set up now are really almost on par with what you get at home. Where do you see the luxury improvements, if you will, of the caravans that you manufacture, given so much has changed over the past 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, it's very interesting, because, you know, if you go back, 15, 20 years, a recreational vehicle was something that allowed you just to get out and go to a caravan park with the family for a few weeks, or, retirees might travel for a period. But now the expectation is you've got all the comforts of home. So you look at, washing machines, they're virtually standard now. You mentioned air conditioning. We've even had Alexa in our Silver Line, so everything was voice controlled, from your TV to your air conditioner, your lights. So where's it heading? A lot of wireless technology coming in. The off-grid technology over the next few years will only get better and better, with battery and solar technology improving, almost weekly. It's one of those things that it's hard to answer where we're going to be in 3 years when, we're focusing on the next 12 months. And once you get the next year's model up and running, you think, oh, what could possibly come out next? And then all of a sudden, all these ideas present themselves, and then you jump onto that as well.
So how far in advance are you sort of planning for it? Because, we see that, each year's new version of the iPhone or whatever it might be. How does that planning come about? Or is it because technology is changing so rapidly, as you've said, you've just got to be willing to adjust, and given the fact that you manufacture in-house, you can do it quite quickly?
Yeah, there's a few key elements. We try and have new models at the beginning of every year, and you might have a major facelift or a minor facelift on that particular product range. So we'll focus on core products each year, and then you rotate, probably every 3 to 4 years and have a major change. But there's also things that present themselves, like if it's a safety thing, like tire pressure monitoring or, sway control. That's something that, we'll look at that, and we'll look at that as an opportunity to improve, and then, we'll just implement that as a running change, as an added customer benefit. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we, you know, we do intermittently, but also our core focus is at the start of every year to have a new model.
We're chatting with Scott Jones, National Head of Sales, Marketing and R&D for Jayco. Scott, before we let you go, the caravanning shows and outdoor shows throughout the year, what can we look forward to actually seeing, touching and walking through as the year unfolds?
Oh, I think because shows have been, you know, probably dormant, I would say, for the last 2 years. It's been tough on the caravan industry from a show perspective. But I know not just at Jayco, but I'm up at a conference on the Gold Coast at the moment, and there's such an air of excitement around it. Everyone wants to get back to shows and you know, have that customer contact again, show them all their new and exciting products. I've been speaking to suppliers already that have told me about some new and exciting things coming. We've got the Melbourne Caravan and Camping Show next week. You know, after that, we've got Sydney. Then we're going to the Perth 4x4 show in Brisbane. So there's a huge amount of things that we're going to see launched. And also, not just this year, even next year. I know they're planning for next year as well. So I think there's a lot coming. So I'd certainly encourage people to get to the shows nationally.
It's one of the things that, unfortunately, through the marine industry, we're not going to see that many of. So it's great to hear that there's going to be the caravan and camping outdoor shows back around the country throughout 2022. I do have one more question I want to ask you, because I sent this through to you off air, but we've seen last week Ford Australia announce that they're going to be retrofitting the F-150 in Australia, which quite clearly is a direct competitor to the Ram that has been so successful. We've seen Silverado. As a manufacturer, does that change how you look at potentially adding the maxi trail or caravans to your lineup, like we see overseas, or is there less of a, I suppose, appeal for it compared to, you know, what we've seen in the marine industry is boats well over 3.5 tons, and there's just not that many vehicles that are well catered to trailering and towing above 3.5 tons. Now, with Ram, with Chev, and with Ford, the 150 coming to Australia, it does give consumers the option. Is that something that you keep an eye on as a caravan manufacturer?
Oh, you certainly do. You know, we're always looking at tow vehicles and popularity, towing capabilities, and with the imports that you've just mentioned, you know, we've found over the years, or the last couple of years, caravans have become heavier and heavier because of all the added benefits that we put in them, like the washing machines and everything that we've spoken about. So what these larger units allow you to do is they just give you I guess, more comfort when towing, because they can tow around that 4.5-ton mark. You know, they're going to tow a caravan with, a 3.5-ton capacity quite easily. You know, and another thing that they're a versatile unit as well. You know, so if you're into horses as well, you know, you can tow a large horse float that, you know, with as many horses as you need to.
Yeah.
So, you know, we certainly keep an eye on that. You know, it allows us to build bigger models. You know, we build up to 24 foot at the moment, you know, in our Silver Line, our flagship range, and that's a unit that's got absolutely everything into it. You know, so I think, you know, those people certainly want to, you know, they want a hamburger with a lot, and that's why they've got the vehicle. So, you know, we keep an eye on it and we cater for it as best we can.
Scott, we really appreciate your time joining Real Adventures this morning. If you'd like at home more information on the Jayco range, head to jayco.com.au for more information. There's walkthroughs, 3D images, you name it, all on their website for more information. Thanks again, Scott.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gearing Up for Dometic, mobile living made easy.
Red's review for Club Marine, Australia's leading provider of boat insurance.
It's time for Red's review, our product of the week for Club Marine, Redmond, our favourites, Club Marine. Both of us have our boats insured by Club Marine, and we're focusing on choosing the right marine binoculars and how much to spend, and is it worth spending that extra few dollars on automatic focus? Now, you spend a huge amount of time fishing for pelagic fish, have spent plenty of time over the last few weeks and months chasing the tuna. I know you spent time up at Burmy, and binoculars can be really beneficial there. Are you more inclined to use and spend the extra few dollars and go autofocus, or what are you spending when you're buying?
I'm gonna straight up answer this honestly. It's something that I don't have, should have, and use more of.
Yeah,
I just don't. I've tried to use poor quality binoculars, and I just can't get the focus ever, Pat. Ever, I just can't. I just can never do it. Now, this is something that I know you've got multiple pairs of. Marty bought you a beautiful set of binoculars for your birthday a little while ago.
Yeah, they're Steiner binoculars.
So,
and they're brilliant. They're really lightweight. They're weatherproof. They've got flexible silicone lenses. There's a really good warranty. The con of it is that they're about $900.
Yep.
They were expensive. And I've found, like, I love these, right? But I found myself not taking them out in the boat because I don't want to ruin them, even though they're weatherproof. So I take out a far cheaper pair. I think I bought them from Anaconda or BCF. I think on memory they were maybe, you know, $150. And even though these are marine binoculars, like waterproof, can float, and I still don't take them out.
Will they catch you more fish? I'm going to 100% say yes. They will.
Totally agree with you.
They will. I think everyone should have a set of binoculars on their boat, and I don't. I just straight up don't. When we went to Burmese only a few weeks ago, Robbie bought a set of binoculars out, and they were a reasonable set, probably something similar to you said. And they worked really well. You could actually see that if someone was hooked up in the distance, you could see a bit of more information than you could see with your own eyes. So if you're off a Polo Bay and you've got to travel to the gas rig and you want to see if there's birds there working, instead of having to drive there, you could literally have someone with a good set of binoculars like you've spoken about.
Autofocus. The other thing is image stabilization. So you're on the boat, moving up and down. Image stabilization, just like on a camera, it's amazing how the image changes and how still you'll have your horizon or you know, your flock of birds or a rough patch of water that you think's got fish. Like, this is something to spend money on.
Can I ask you a question?
Far away.
Can it get you seasick looking through them?
Well, I would say no, because image stabilization means, like, if you're going to get sick, you're going to get sick. But image stabilization means the image, it freezes. It doesn't move as much. I think this is a really beneficial thing. Like, we had this conversation, and I've spent the money on Mads, my beautiful wife, looked after me. And if you're interested in more info on binoculars, we simply Googled it, and then we had a debate during the week, Redmond, and we went to, I think it was Wow Travel was the website, and they had 13 different sets of binoculars. It wasn't necessarily set to Australia, but globally, you know, who's using what, and they have the price breakdowns. I think if you've got the money, it's around the $800 to $900 you'll spend. You can spend less, but they're one of those things that you do that are beneficial in a boat, particularly as we come into this big bluefin tuna season, Redmond.
Yeah, birds, I trust my eyes a lot. Like, I see, they're trained, like sort of like the way your football. You can see a footy, you can do whatever you can do playing footy. With my eyes, when I'm like these bluefin that I'm seeing offshore that people can't see and birds in the distance, your eyes just are naturally changed to see things, trained to see things. And I think I need to get a set of these to put on the boat just to make my life, not necessarily even my life, I can dedicate someone on the boat to actually have a look in certain areas in distances. It doesn't have to be for 5 hours of the day. It can just be, what's that over there? Instead of driving over to see that one bird that was annoying you, they can, depending on the binoculars and the money you spend, the distance, you can literally get a good vision of what's going on to see if it's worth going over there. It's something that I'm going to be putting. Now, I haven't even thought about it as of weeks and weeks, so we're going to, since Burmese, and I'm going to have to get myself a set of these, probably not $800, maybe the $150 from BCF.
For those interested, I've got the Steiner Navigator Pro, the 7x50 binoculars. So that's just personally what I use.
Well, you had, and now in my boat.
That is Red's review for Club Marine, our product review of the week.
That was Red's review for Club Marine. Insure your boat or jet ski with Club Marine, Australia's leading provider of boat insurance. Check the PDS to see if this insurance is right for you.
You're listening to Real Adventures with Patrick Dangerfield and Aaron Hadgood.
Welcome back to Real Adventures. It's time for Red's Tip.
We spoke at the start of the show, a bit of the school holidays, Pat, a bit of that offshore wind, trying to keep warm. Something that I seen during the week driving over the Bowen Heads Bridge. I thought it was a fantastic idea and a good tip out there. I'm claiming this one. Driving over, there was a group of family fishing off the actual Heads Bridge in itself, facing an onshore southerly, which comes through the bar, through the Bowen Heads Bluff, on the inside of the Bowen Heads Bluff. And sure enough, they were smart enough to have built a tarp-like, as tarpy matty thing, we'll go with, from Bunnings. Does that sound relevant?
A tarpy matty.
Well, it looked warmer than a tarp, Pat, and it didn't quite look like a mat, so we're going with it. Get yourself a tarp and somehow attach it to the pier that you are fishing on.
Ocky straps.
Ocky straps will work well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If duct tape can't fix it, that nothing can. Seriously, in front of you, whatever, so person's only a meter, like two of you is a meter wide, would cover you enough, and you can get behind it. But the rods are actually sitting, leaning up against the pier, so you can see the tips of your rods clean. You can't see the water too easy, but at least only half your body, if you stand up, is going to be cold. Look, rather, it's like fishing in a boat being protected.
I thought this
was incredible.
As we come into school holidays.
And the winter months.
And you want the family to get into it, you've got to make sure you're providing in something that's a little bit of protection. I think it's a great thing.
I thought this was, I even took a photo of it and sent it to you. I said, Red's tip this week is this one, because I thought it was a great idea. So a tarpy matty thingy is what you need. I don't think it'll cost you too much. I'm sure Bunnings has it. You're the Bunnings expert these days. You've got a couple of tools from there. And that's Red's tip for the week.
Nice work. Now, Red's, the flying gaff this week.
Probably going at me.
No, it's not. It's this little, slightly dated news, but there was a group of Victorian fishos who were fishing in the Murray River, celebrating Labor Day long weekend, left with nearly a $5,500 fine for taking fish they shouldn't have, as well as not having New South Wales fishing licences. Now, Victorians must have a valid New South Wales fishing licence to fish the Murray River.
Really?
So they caught...
I actually didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So the haul, I mean...
So on the Victorian side?
Yeah, so they were in the river.
Yeah, gotcha.
The haul, though, included trout, cod and silver perch, and under New South Wales fishing regs, trout cod's listed as endangered. So that's why you get the big whack in terms of fines. But Vicos must have a New South Wales fishing licence to fish the Murray River. So that's where the boys, they get the gaff this weekend. That's a, you know, $5,500. That's almost 100 litres of fuel, Aaron. That's hurting this week.
Try driving to Apollo Bay and catching nothing all day and using $4,000 of fuel.
Well, you need to do better this week as we head into next week's
good
show.
Good luck in the footy tonight. You've got a big game ahead. We'll see you. Big pie game. We'll see you next week.